Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, happy daylight savings time, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, from London, England, where it's been a warm, sunny, almost summery kind of day today. Last week, a week ago today, I was in New Orleans, Louisiana. It was a warm, summery, sunny kind of day. I'm beginning to incline towards the conclusion that this climate change thing is real. I mean, warm and sunny in London on, the 9th of March? That this climate change thing is real, and it's caused by man, specifically me. Because I've been here in both places, and it's, you see what I'm saying? If you're wondering why President Hamid Karzai, who again this week gave an interview where he expressed extreme anger at Americans after America's longest war sort of stumbles to an end, kind of an end. he expressed, quote, extreme anger. And you'll hear one reason why during the apologies of the week, but this might be another reason. From the BBC, half of all children under five in Afghanistan are suffering from the effects of malnutrition. Half of all children under five in Afghanistan. After 13 years of Western military intervention and billions of dollars spent on aid, the United Nations says the situation is critical, especially in Helmand province, where Britain has been kind of running the show. No, didn't even bring Marmite. And another number for your consideration. As you listen to news stories about the horrible drought in California, Mother Jones reports production rates for thirsty crops like alfalfa and cotton have diminished significantly in the last few years in California. Between 2006 and 2010 alone, the amount of land irrigated for cotton in Central California fell by 46%. What does that tell you? It tells you that California has been giving, selling federally subsidized water to farmers in the Central Valley to grow the thirstiest crops humans grow. Alfalfa, cotton, and rice. They didn't even mention rice here. Rice in California. Did I say it on the radio last week? I don't know. I should listen to this show. Forget Keystone. We should just build a pipeline from Louisiana to Los Angeles for the water. There's so much water in New Orleans. You know, just the... Ladies and gentlemen, What the frack? For the past 8 months, the Center for Public Integrity, Inside Climate News, and the Weather Channel have examined what Texas, the nation's biggest oil producer, has done to protect people in one of the major shale oil drilling areas, the Eagle Ford, from the industry's pollutants. What's happening in the Eagle Ford, this report from Bloomberg, is important not only for Texas, but also for Pennsylvania, Colorado, North Dakota, and other states where horizontal drilling and high-volume fracking have made it profitable to extract oil and gas from shale. This, by the way, is interesting in light of the fact that one of the things we're being told the United States should do in the context of the current Ukraine matter is to export some of our newly abundant natural gas to Ukraine and other countries in Europe to diminish the influence that Russian supplies of natural gas have on that area. Because we got so much natural gas thanks to fracking. Here's the price. The investigation and records obtained from Texas regulatory agencies reveal a system that does more to protect the industry than the public. Among the findings, Texas air monitoring system is so flawed, the state knows almost nothing about the extent of the pollution in the Eagle Ford drilling area. Only 5 permanent air monitors are installed in 20,000 square miles, and all are at the fringes of the shale drilling area, far from the heavy drilling areas where emissions are highest. Thousands of oil and gas facilities are allowed to self-audit their emissions without reporting them to the state. Notice how this is becoming a trend? Yeah, you guys can self-police. You're good. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which regulates most air emissions, doesn't even know some of these facilities exist. An internal agency document acknowledges that the rule allowing this practice, quote, cannot be proven to be protective, unquote. Companies that break the law are rarely fined. The Texas legislature has cut the Environmental Quality Commission's budget by a third since the drilling boom began. There's been a 100% statewide increase in unplanned toxic air releases associated with oil and gas production since 2009. Known as emission events, these releases are usually caused by human error or faulty equipment. Residents of the mostly rural counties in the Eagle Ford area are at a disadvantage even in Texas because they haven't been given air quality protection, such as more permanent monitors provided to your Dallases and your Fort Worths in the Barnett Shale region. Texas officials tasked with overseeing the industry are often its strongest defenders. Oil money is so thoroughly ingrained in the Texas culture and economy, there's little interest in or sympathy for those who have become collateral damage in the drive for more oil and gas drilling. The Environmental Quality Commission is led by three commissioners appointed by Governor Rick Perry, who favors dismantling the EPA. TCEQ officials often go on to jobs as lobbyists for the energy industry they once regulated. The Texas Railroad Commission, which issues drilling permits and regulates all other aspects of oil and gas production, is controlled by three elected commissioners who accepted more than $2 million in campaign contributions from the oil and gas industry during the 2012 election cycle. State legislators who enact the laws that regulate the industry are often tied to it. Nearly one in four state legislators, or his or her spouse, has a financial interest in at least one energy company active in the Eagle Ford drilling area. I believe if you're anti-oil and gas, you're anti-Texas, said one Republican representative. The Texas Air Quality, Texas CEQ, what does it stand for again? I'll get it. I got it for you here. Commission on Environmental Quality knows its statewide air monitoring system is flawed, according to an interoffice memorandum. The executive director has extensive records of underestimated or previously undetected emissions from oil and gas sites. These are not isolated instances, but have occurred statewide and indicate a pattern, said the then deputy director of the Office of Permitting and Registration, writing in a memo. He's now the executive director of the commission, and he declined comment. You got my memo? Heck, would have been his comment had he not declined. Hello, welcome to the show.
Woke up this morning, wanted to cry. Then I remembered, yes, I know why. He's a real good one for having his cake. I'm gonna go fishing or jump in the lake. I'm going fishing. That's what I'll do. Think about nothing, not even you. Catch a real big one, a big speckled trout. Snapping in the water, I'll pull him on out. Sweet talking liar, spin me a yarn. Tell me a story, big as a barn. Gonna stop listening, I won't hear you out. I'm gonna go fishing and catch me a trout. If a man is a liar, a man is a fool. Playing for keepers and breaking the rules. He'll be the loser, yes, he'll find out. I'm gonna go fishing and catch me a trout. Thank you.
look at him shine. There goes a big one. That one is mine. Can't stop the reel now. I've got the feel now. Snap goes the fine fly rod. I'll catch me a trout.
From London, England, home of Boris Johnson. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition, and home of two new CD machines. Congratulations to us. We're busting our buttons over here. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, news from outside the bubble. Only because I was in Dublin late this week did this story come to my attention. It's from the Irish Times. Detailed figures have emerged to illustrate how Apple, you know, you've heard of them, computer company, has managed to pay almost no corporation tax for years on billions of dollars of revenue earned in other countries using Irish entities. According to accounts obtained by the Irish Times for one of these unlimited companies, Apple Sales International, ASI, the consumer electronics giant, cut its Irish tax bill by more than $850 million between 2004 and 2008 using an unexplained lower rate. ASI, Apple Sales International, provides sales and marketing services to Apple subsidiaries around the world that sell iPods and iPads. Between 2004 and 2008, it reported profits before tax totaling $7.11 billion on sales of more than $20 billion. New documents show that Apple has what Apple has done. Apple has been severely criticized in recent days in Australia over its use of Ireland to avoid tax on profits earned there. The accounts for those years state the corporation tax that would be due using Ireland's 12.5% rate was $890 million over the 5 years, but they also show how much corporation tax ASI actually paid, just $36 million. The difference between the two figures is explained each year by saying some profits were taxed at lower rates than Ireland's 12.5% corporate tax rate. The accounts do not explain by whom or how this rate was decided or in what jurisdiction the lower rate was paid, the lower tax was paid. The current tax charge is lower than the standard rate in Ireland, it says. There's no suggestion that Apple's accounting was in any way illegal. However, it may reignite anger in Ireland and the United States over the way large multinationals are able to manage their tax affairs. The figures have emerged only now from forgotten filings in Australia. ASI, being unlimited in Ireland, does not have to file annual accounts, but it was obliged to file its Irish accounts with authorities in Australia. An analysis of ASI's figures by the Australian Financial Review this week estimated Apple shifted almost $9 billion Australian dollars of its profits earned in that country to Ireland. Last year, Apple was criticized by a U.S. Senate panel for avoiding billions of dollars in taxes by moving profits through Irish subsidiaries. Apple executives admitted in those hearings that the company paid a top tax rate of 2%. 2%. Did I say it again? 2% on $74 billion worth of sales outside North America over the previous 3 years, largely through use of tax structures in Ireland. There's more to Ireland than this, but this is pretty good, too. Apple told the Senate committee hearing into its tax affairs it had a special tax deal as part of its decision to set up an Irish operation in 1980. That was later denied by the Irish government. Celtic tiger or pussycat? You be the judge. It also emerged at the U.S. hearing that some of Apple's Irish entities were avoiding corporation tax because they are stateless, not tax resident in any jurisdiction, owing to a wacky loophole in Irish tax law. However, the first mention by ASI that the company is stateless for tax purposes doesn't appear in its accounts until 2009, the final year for which figures were obtained by the Irish Times. Apple declined to comment. The Irish Department of Finance also declined to comment. But the Minister for Finance says he has closed the stateless loophole as of this tax year. Let me, ladies and gentlemen, be absolutely clear in sharing that information with you. As the story from the Irish Times mentioned, it's Apple has done nothing illegal. They are taking advantage of what's in the laws. So nobody is at least on this broadcast, is saying, oh, hey, I'm more moral than Apple or Apple is evil. But how do those loopholes get into the laws in the first place? Did a comet fall on the Irish legislature containing, hey, here's some loopholes the aliens would like you to put in? I don't think so. But you have the chief executives of our largest technology companies hanging around with and contributing a lot of money to, at least in the United States, folks who are at the top of our political structure. And I don't think they're hanging around with them just to give them tips on how to create folders on your iPhone. Just a surmise on my part. From The Guardian, also about Ireland, also helping to prove that Homo is not sapiens. Dublin is at the center of a new house price boom. Dublin is the world's fifth fastest rising property market. This raises concerns over a new asset bubble. They're just barely getting over the last one. The banks of the River Liffey, did you know that? It's the river that goes through Dublin. I learned it this week. That's why, of course, the famous song, Cry Me a Liffey. The banks are hosting a resurgent property market exceeded only by Jakarta, Auckland, New Zealand, Bali, and Christchurch, New Zealand. A report on global house prices found Dublin property prices rose faster than Los Angeles, Tokyo, and Dubai. Values increased by 17.5% last year. The population, scarred by the consequences of the last property boom, a $80 billion rescue loan from a trio of international lenders that put the Irish economy in the toilet for a good many years. The population is wary of signs of a house market recovery. A group representing thousands of Irish mortgage holders has raised concerns over the price increases in houses, pointing to thousands of repossessed properties. See if this sounds familiar, if you've been listening to this program over time. Thousands of repossessed properties that are not on the market and whose absence from the market could be holding up the prices of houses that are being sold. Eve Smith of Naked Capitalism pointed out a couple of years ago on this broadcast that's exactly what's happening in the United States. Homes being foreclosed and being held by banks off the market so as not to depress or to help to increase the price of housing. David Hall, co-founder of the Irish Mortgage Holders Association campaign group, said the latest figures on mortgage arrears this year showed that there were 1,600 empty properties held by the Irish banks not on the market. He also pointed out that the state agency, which bought thousands of properties abandoned by banks and builders after the crash, has held back 14,000 properties from the Dublin market. As a consequence, house prices are higher, said Hall. Property prices in rich Dublin area codes may have increased by 22% last year, but tens of thousands of Irish mortgage holders are still underwater, and probably the River Liffey to blame, and the hikes in the cost of a house are restricted to the richer suburbs of the Irish capital. South of the Liffey. For a small country such as the Republic, says the Guardian, property prices remain stagnant outside Dublin. The total value of mortgage arrears, I guess that means foreclosures or people behind, was about $2 billion, including almost all of that owed by borrowers who had fallen behind in their payments for more than a year. Global ratings agency Fitch predicted further mortgage repossessions in Ireland this year. One in five houses where mortgages had been in arrears for more than 3 months could be repossessed, said Fitch. Still 700 ghost estates, the name given to empty private housing estates, projects, we would say, or tracts, built during the boom, many of them new mini-towns constructed around the edges of Greater Dublin. Ghost mini-towns, ladies and ghost mini-new towns. Want to live there? Warning there must be no more debt-fueled property sprees, the Irish finance minister, Michael Noonan, said. We can't go mad again. unquote. And yet. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And now, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Ah, to be gazing on the banks of the Liffey. The ice-free season across the Arctic is getting longer by 5 days per decade, according to new research from a team including Professor Julian Strove at University College London. New analysis of satellite data shows the Arctic Ocean absorbing ever more of the sun's energy in summer, leading to an ever later appearance of ice in the autumn. In some regions, autumn freeze-up is occurring up to 11 days per decade later than it used to. The research published in a forthcoming issue of the journal Geophysical Research Letters, my favorite research letters, has implications for tracking climate change as well as having practical applications for shipping and the resource industry in the Arctic regions. By which they mean, drill for oil in the Arctic, screw the Russians. Quote, the extent of sea ice in the Arctic has been declining for the last 4 decades, says the researcher, and the timing of when melt begins and ends has a large impact on the amount of ice lost each summer. With the Arctic region becoming more accessible for long periods of time, there's a growing need for improved prediction of when the ice retreats and reforms in the winter. Unquote. If it reforms, babe. And I wasn't babying you, researcher lady. While temperatures have been increasing during all calendar months, trends in melt onset are considerably smaller than that of autumn freeze-up. Nevertheless, whatever that means, the timing of melt onset strongly influences how much of the sun's energy gets absorbed by the ice and sea. Highly reflective surfaces such as ice are said to have a high albedo, as they reflect most of the incoming heat back into space. Less reflective surfaces, like liquid water, have a low albedo and absorb most of the heat that is directed at them. This means even a small change in the extent of sea ice in spring can lead to vastly more heat being absorbed over the summer, leading to substantially later onset of ice in the autumn. Kind of a loop. Hey, here's good news for mosquitoes. Researchers have found that people living in the highlands of Africa and South America are at an increased risk of catching mosquito-borne diseases like malaria during hotter years. They believe that temperature rises in the future could result in millions of additional cases in some areas. The research is published in the journal Science, which means millions more people are going to have really bad dreams because the medication of choice to try to protect you against malaria is its chief side effect is it gives you really bad. It interferes with your sleep and it gives you really bad dreams. Those would seem to be the same side effect, but just described differently. Anyway, so prepare for that. Prepare for some wacky night times. Professor Mercedes Pascual from University of Michigan, who carried out the research, said the impact in terms of increasing the risk of exposure to disease is very large. Areas at higher altitudes have traditionally provided a haven from malaria. The expansion could, in a sense, account for the substantial part of the increase of cases we've already observed in these areas, says Professor Pascual. Both the malaria parasite and the mosquito that carries it struggle to cope with cooler air. Professor Pascual says the risk of the disease decreases with altitude, and this is why historically people have settled in these higher regions. So maybe you have to move to blimps. The scientists say the disease is entering new regions that had previously been malaria-free. To investigate, scientists looked at densely populated areas in the highlands of Colombia and Ethiopia, where there are detailed records of both temperature and malaria cases from the last 3 decades. They found that in warmer years, malaria shifted higher into the mountains. In cooler years, it was limited to lower elevations. The highlands of Ethiopia could be more vulnerable to malaria if temperatures rise. Nearly half the population live at altitude. Scientists believe there could be many more cases. Because people living in areas that have never been exposed to malaria are particularly vulnerable to the disease, attempts to stop the spread should be focused on areas at the edges of the spread of the disease. It's easier to control there than at lower altitudes where it's already established. Bad dreams, ladies and gentlemen. I only had one. I took this medication once. My wife had bad dreams. I had one. It wasn't such a bad dream. It was just a dream of a bad joke. But that, you know, for somebody in my business, you can't have a worse dream than dreaming a bad joke. Since the Industrial Revolution, about one-third of the carbon dioxide produced by burning fossil fuels has been absorbed by the oceans, making the water more acidic. When carbon dioxide is absorbed, it reacts with seawater to produce carbonic acid. This causes suffering for coral reefs, oysters, clams, scallops, sea urchins, and even some plankton. Fishers in British Columbia, according to the CBC, are seeing yet another season of dramatic declines in the number of scallops as well as a lower quality to their shells. In acidic waters, shells grow thinner, providing less protection for the animals. It also lowers their immune systems, so more are killed off by disease. These effects of ocean acidification and rising seawater temperatures due to climate change are showing up in all parts of the world. As we know, half of the Earth's coral reefs have been bleached out because the algae that live in symbiosis with the corals and give it its color cannot tolerate the changing conditions. These damn inflexible algae. You cannot tolerate them, eh? What about us? These ocean creatures that are affected by acidification are at the bottom of the food chain, so we're eroding the very foundation of life in the sea during a time when we are depending more and more on the oceans as a source of food. Ocean acidification is an invisible menace, says the CBC, that threatens the entire ecosystem, and it's only getting worse. They ran this story to sort of contrast it with the fears about Fukushima radiation in the water, which they propose as a much lesser threat at the moment than ocean acidification, even though the latter gets much less attention right now. Also from the CBC, new research reveals a nasty mucus-like algae bloom that emerged in eastern Canada in 2006. It may not be an invasive species after all. It indeed appears to be a native species that was once subdued by cooler temperatures, but is now proliferating because of climate change. Graduate student Michelle Lavery was the lead author on a report indicating Dynamo is a native algae species. It's previously believed to have been an invasive species from elsewhere. It's a thick, slippery algae nicknamed, pardon me now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm reading this, nicknamed rock snot for reasons obvious to anyone who has seen or touched it. The algae is concerned for fish populations such as Atlantic salmon as it lines river bottoms, hiding food and making it more difficult for some species to forage or just grossing them out. It's like a really bad 70s shag carpet, says University of New Brunswick graduate student Lavery, the lead author on the report, published in the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences. Dynamo was not known in eastern Canada until it suddenly appeared in New Brunswick and Quebec waters, rivers and lakes in 2006. It has also been observed east of the Rockies in Alberta, but also in British Columbia, where its appearance was thought to have been linked to the rise of felt-soled fishing boots. I want to meet the man who came up with that theory. Such boots have been banned in some U.S. states. Oh, there you go, over concerns they might be transferring Dynamo. The new research reveals the slimy, porous algae that has been reshaping eastern Canadian rivers is not new. It has been found in dated sediments from 1970. But researchers believe warming temperatures brought it back to prominence in recent years. More than 20,000 crops from more than 100 nations have arrived at a doomsday vault in the Arctic Circle. The latest delivery coincides with the 6th anniversary of the frozen depository in Svalbard, which now houses more than 800,000 samples, according to the BBC. The shipment includes the first offering from Japan, where collections were threatened. They were collecting seeds there. Those collections were threatened by the devastating earthquake and tsunami. The facility is designed to withstand all natural and human disasters. Yeah, we know how well that works. Deep inside a mountain on a remote island in the Svalbard archipelago, located halfway between mainland Norway and the North Pole, the vault, which cost $7 million and took 12 months to build, offers permanent protection for the world's food crops, say its operators, the Norwegian government, and the Global Crop Diversity Trust. There you have duplicates of all seed samples from crop collections around the world. Don't tell Monsanto. And the U.S. Defense Department stresses threats to global stability and American prominence, posed by climate change in its latest quadrennial defense review, declaring that an erratic climate will likely cause increased terrorist activity, among other impacts. Like its previous versions in 2006 and 2010, the quadrennial defense review this year highlights threats, some more predictable others, than global climate change will present to human civilization. The impacts of climate change may increase the frequency, scale, and complexity of future missions, including defense support to civil authorities, while at the same time undermining the capacity of our domestic installations to support training activities. Climate change poses another significant challenge for the United States and the world at large, says the Pentagon report. As greenhouse gas emissions increase, sea levels are rising, average global temperatures are increasing, and severe weather patterns are accelerating. A warming planet will likely, quote, exacerbate water scarcity and lead to sharp increases in food costs, the report says, leading to devastated infrastructure and living conditions, especially in poorer regions of the world. Note to Republicans, that's the Pentagon. Increased water scarcity. Well, then let's use millions of gallons of them to frack some gas, shall we? News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. It's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
I know a little bit about a lot of things, but I don't know enough about you. Just when I think you're mine, you try a different line. And baby, what can I do? I read the latest news, no buttons on my shoes. But baby, I'm confused about you. You get me in a spin, oh, what a stew I'm in. 'Cause I don't know enough about you. Jack of all trades, master of none. And isn't it a shame? I'm so sure that you'd be good for me if you'd only play my game. You know I went to school and I'm nobody's fool. That is to say, until I met you, I know a little bit about a lot of things, but I don't know enough about you. That is to say, until I met you, I know a little bit about a lot of things, but I don't know enough about you.
This is Le Show from London, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
Sorry.
Mainly international apologies this week, but this, first of all, apropos of what got Hamid Karzai ticked off. There's been no issue in Afghanistan more sensitive than NATO airstrikes, which President Karzai has long protested as inhumane and ineffective. They are now carried out by both unmanned and manned aircraft. The coalition knows the location of every Afghan outpost, says Abdul Wali, head of the Logar Provincial Council. How can such incidents happen? A NATO airstrike this week has killed five Afghan soldiers, is how. Western officials were quick to apologize for the airstrike, which occurred before sunrise Thursday. In a statement, the U.S.-led International Security Assistance Force said the aircraft was performing reconnaissance for an Afghan operation when it, quote, engaged suspected insurgents on a ridge. It was later determined that suspected insurgents were Afghan National Army soldiers. We value the strong relationship with our Afghan partners, and we will determine what actions will be taken to ensure incidents like this do not happen again, unquote. Like getting out. Dateline Ottawa, Canada's defense minister has apologized to the family of a soldier whose mother received a government check following her son's death upon his return from Afghanistan, a check for one penny. Rob Nicholson says, quote, an insensitive bureaucratic screw-up, as opposed to a sensitive bureaucratic screw-up, resulted in the one-cent check being sent to the mother of Corporal Justin Stark. The check was sent from the Public Works Department and was marked as CF release pay. It's not clear why it was sent, but it clearly incensed. Government defense minister told the House of Commons he would look into the matter. Also, a Canadian apology. Liberal Party leader Justin Trudeau apologized for joking that Moscow might vent its Olympic hockey frustration that crisis hit Ukraine, saying he regrets making light of some very real fears Ukrainians might have about the prospect of Russian intervention there. He said he didn't issue a mea culpa when the controversy emerged after his remarks aired on a French-language talk show because he doesn't speak... No, because he wanted first to reach out and talk personally to the Ukrainian-Canadian community leaders. He expressed his regret that it was a poor choice of words. He apologizes for his mistake, and he wants to ensure we understand the Liberal Party is fully in support of the people of the Ukraine, said Paul Grod, the head of the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress. Dateline Lygiades, Greece, a visibly emotional German president apologized profoundly Friday for a massacre by German soldiers in a northwestern Greek village during World War II. This coming at the end of a three-day visit that combined political talks with efforts to bring closure to wounds from the wartime German occupation. Speaking at a hillside monument in Lygiades, Joachim Gauck expressed shame at the 1943 atrocity when Nazi troops executed dozens of villagers, including months-old babies, in reprisal for a partisan attack. He was accompanied by the Greek president, who was a resistance fighter as a teenager. I wish to articulate what the perpetrators and those who were politically responsible for so many years in the post-war period did not want or were not able to utter, Gauck said, that what happened here was a brutal injustice, and it is with feelings of shame and pain that I beg forgiveness from the families of those who were murdered, unquote. His apology came at a time of increased anti-German sentiment in Greece, as Berlin, the largest single contributor to Greece's bailout, has also been one of the most ardent proponents of austerity measures imposed in return for the rescue loans. Those austerity measures seem to have resulted in a Greek unemployment rate that now hovers around 50%. That resentment has fueled growing calls for Germany to pay Greece reparations for the brutal 1941-44 occupation and restitution or repayment for a forced wartime loan Germany forced Greece to pay to Germany. Dateline Tokyo, a disgraced composer once hailed as Japan's Beethoven, apologized this week for lying about his career but stood by his claim that he was partly deaf. His first public appearance since the scandal broke last month, Mamoru Samuragochi said at a packed news conference in Tokyo that, quote, I'm truly sorry for the trouble I caused with my lies. He'd been known for penning highly acclaimed symphonies, but his elaborate facade came tumbling down after another man came forward in early February to say he had actually composed most of the works and had invented Bitcoin. No, the latter is not true. Not even according to Newsweek. And John Travolta has apologized for his already legendary Oscar night fluff when he mispronounced the name of the star of Frozen, Idina Menzel, as he introduced her performance of Let It Go, the song that won the Oscar for Best Song. Travolta commented, I've been beating myself up all day. John, let me do it. Then I thought, what would Idina Menzel say? She'd say, let it go, let it go. He called her Adela Dazeem. She has not yet commented on the blunder. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And speaking of the Oscars, Wall Street Journal reports that Ellen's selfie on the Oscars was not a spontaneous act. Oh, no. Really? No. Samsung spent an estimated $20 million on ads to run during the commercial breaks, but it may have gotten more promotional mileage from the selfie. She toyed with the white Samsung phone during the broadcast. as part of Samsung sponsorship, the TV network airing the show, ABC, negotiated to have the smartphone integrated into the show, according to two people familiar with the matter. Samsung gave ABC smartphones to use during the broadcast and was promised its devices would get airtime, these people said. Oh, my God. A television broadcast devoted to the non-commercial promotion of the arts? Sabotage by product placement, ladies and gentlemen. I am shocked, as I'm sure you are. The crisis in the Ukraine continues unmentioned on American media, I think, at least on the Yak shows, but pointed out by an analyst for the BBC yesterday morning. Apparently, the United States gave assurances to Gorbachev as the Soviet Union came to an end that NATO would not expand to the former Warsaw Pact countries. And in the intervening 20 years, NATO has expanded to the former Warsaw Pact countries. Aside from his personality, maybe that's on Putin's mind. Anyway, news that trying to strategize a Western response to the continuing crisis in Crimea. There's a phone conversation today between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and British Foreign Minister William Hague. Apparently that call's been tapped.
Yes, Rose?
Mr. Secretary, I have Foreign Minister Hague for you.
Oh, put him on.
Yes, sir. Mr. Minister, Secretary Kerry is tied up watching Ellen at the moment.
Rose, I want to talk to the minister.
I'm sorry, sir. I thought you told me to put him on, and that was...
Just connect me to him, please. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Minister, I was hoping we wouldn't have to disrupt our weekends like this, but it's always a pleasure.
Well, I'm sure one of those two things you said is true, and I'm in total agreement. Have you heard anything from our friend Foreign Minister Lavrov lately?
Well, just that he offered me a discount weekend at the Crimea Four Seasons.
That's not very encouraging.
Well, they do have an infinity pool. But, yes, it points to a Russian determination to rely on facts on the ground at this point.
Well, you know, of course, that my government is prepared to back any approach that your government makes, sort of a measure that would inflict harm on our people.
Well, last night we were mooting the notion of freezing the assets of Russian oligarchs held in Western banks.
Well, you see, that's an example of something that would hurt our people.
Well, I suppose if you accept the notion that banks are people...
John, if word gets around the Russian oligarch community that their billions are no longer safe in British banks, you can just imagine the highly paid jobs that might go redundant in very short order.
Boy, well taken. On the other hand, Bill, my president has gone on the public record saying that a continuation of this kind of behavior on the part of the Russians will inevitably incur serious costs.
Yes, and if you look at it in a certain way, of course, that's a truism. Just as an example, it must cost the Russians good money to transport their troops across the border into Crimea. We could trumpet that.
I'm going to suggest that at the principals' meeting later today, if you don't mind.
And then certainly, I think in the longer term, if we wish to defuse this situation, we might want to look at President Putin's distress vis-a-vis the continuing expansion of NATO.
Oh, we're already on that. We've put out some very discreet feelers to other nations on Russia's border that might be interested in joining NATO, and so far we've had a very encouraging response from Mongolia. We think that would distress him big time.
I think that would be quite likely. It might encourage him to go further into Ukraine in response, though, don't you think?
Well, if he does, Kazakhstan would join NATO on condition that we take the word Atlantic out of its name. They think it's provincial. But, Mr. Minister, if you have any ideas, I'd be more than interested in hearing them. Clearly, the West's inability to move any military force more substantial than a Coast Guard cutter into the area is a somewhat limiting factor in this situation.
Well, I was thinking, following on our threat to eject the Russians from the G8, we might want to go a little further in that direction, by which I mean consider forcing them out of other international organizations as well.
Well, we can't quite kick them out of the UN, can we?
No, but I've canvassed the members, and I do think we have a substantial majority willing to eject the Russians from the International Postal Union. That tale has quite a stinger in it.
Let me build on that idea in a way. Radio Moscow is still on shortwave, isn't it?
I believe so, although I'd have to have my assistant check on it. Simon, check on Radio Moscow, please.
Yes, sir.
If I'm not mistaken, we still have the capability to jam it. We'd have to figure out how all that works again, I suppose. But
my prime minister did have one idea which might perhaps have the greatest ability to make President Putin feel some substantial pain.
I'm just getting word there's a cabinet meeting in a few minutes. What's the idea?
Well, in very short strokes, we arranged to have Pussy Riot perform at next year's Grammys.
Interesting. I think the First Lady just might have a couple of Grammy connections.
Perhaps even give them some sort of special Grammy, if there is such a thing.
That might be a bridge too far. But, Mr. Minister, very productive conversation. Let's talk again tomorrow.
Tomorrow I'm going Chinese water deer hunting. Definitely Tuesday.
Yes, you got it. Thanks.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right round the seven oceans, drive it straight into deep blue sea. He's the sweetest Tupelo honey. He's an angel of the first degree. He's the sweetest Tupelo honey. Just like honey, baby, from the bee. Old Manhattan. I've never been there, but I wanna go. Standing waiting on my number, and my number is gonna show.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from our friend the Atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save,
Eddie, you enjoying the summer weather here in London?
Yeah. Got a proton burn today.
No, really. New Mexico has extended the time for keeping atomic waste above ground after last month's radioactive release at an underground repository, the federally run Waste Isolation Pilot Plant.
It's called WIP.
Yes, it is. Remains closed following the February release of a small quantity of radiation from the subterranean dump. In the meantime, dozens of atomic waste-filled containers sent from other federal sites to the repository for disposal are being left in the site's parking lot and waste handling facility. The facility is allowed to keep radioactive waste in the parking area for no more than a month under its permit with the New Mexico government, and in the handling facility for no more than 2 months. However, since the repository remains closed, state government officials are extending the two deadlines to give the U.S. Energy Department time to devise a plan for handling the nuclear waste in the future.
Need a lot of time.
Yeah. New thinking is based on the possibility the underground portion of the facility might stay closed for more than 3 months, according to an administrative decision. Officials last week hinted it could be weeks before workers are allowed to return to the underground part of the waste plant, where at least 13 personnel were exposed to radioactive contaminants last month.
Bet they're enjoying the time off.
I bet they are. Good point. Lemonade. Radioactive waste piles up in Tokyo. This is more waste.
It's like you're fixated on the waste thing.
Yeah, it is. More than 500 tons of radioactive waste consisting of incinerator ash are being stored at the Tegunoma disposal site, about 800 meters from Chiba Prefecture. It's part of the thousands of tons of radioactive waste that remain in temporary storage in the Tokyo area nearly 3 years after the triple meltdown at Fuke. 32 lawsuits filed a lawsuit in January against the Chiba prefectural government demanding that the radioactive waste temporarily stored in their neighborhood be removed immediately. It contains more than 8,000 becquerels of radioactive cesium per kilogram and has been designated for special processing.
It's better than the ordinary processing, isn't it?
It is! At the end of last year, 12 prefectures were storing a total of 140,000 tons of the waste. The basic rule is to have each prefectural government find a final disposal site for radioactive waste produced within its jurisdiction through garbage incineration or sewage treatment, of course, which doesn't get rid of the radioactivity.
Nothing does. It's forever. Kinda.
More radioactive waste has been found leaking between the shells of Hanford's oldest double-shell tank. The Department of Energy confirmed that one tank had waste in two places between its shells. Wednesday, it learned that waste had been discovered in a third place. We just further believe this reinforces the need to pump this tank. We're really concerned, said the director of the Washington State Department of Ecology's nuclear waste program. The state had criticized DOE for its plan to monitor the waste but take no action unless conditions worsened. The state asked for a plan to pump the waste from the tank, which DOE already was scheduled to deliver. But they have no plan. They're going to start buying equipment and making other plans to remove the sludge from the tank. Pumping will start no sooner than March 2016.
So get used to the waste.
Hanford workers spotted the new waste during a biweekly inspection of the largest pool of dried waste in the underground tank's annulus, or the space between its shells.
So that would be an annulus horribilis?
It would. A video camera lowered down a riser that provides access to the annulus showed a shadow in place previously thought to be bare when a video camera was lowered down the riser closest to that spot. The new dried waste was found. It's about 7 feet by 21 inches, less than an inch deep. Nothing, right?
I'm just thinking about annuluses.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission said Thursday that as of December 31st, 80 of 100 nuclear power reactors in the United States met their safety and security performance objectives. Those 80 received normal inspection results, the NRC said in its annual assessment letters, an annual report card on the performance of the nation's nuclear power plants. 80 out of 100 are normal. What can that possibly tell you about the other 20? Clean, cheap, safe. Too safe to be normal, our friend the atom. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude today's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via two sources, whenever you want it, on the internet, harryshear.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through WWNO.org, Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And it'd be just like cleaning up that annulus if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Adrian Bodenham here at Global Radio in London, and thanks to Janie at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this broadcast and a playlist, Jenny Lawson, the playlist of the music heard here on, and a store where Cars I Talk t-shirts are still just $5. That's all available at harryshear.com. And yes, fans of Twitter, I'm there at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from London.